And welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events in Valparaiso and throughout Northwest Indiana. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, alongside with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City. We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Our 2018 underwriters for Art on the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum and our landlord, Walt Breitinger. If you'd like to find out more about leasing space in our historic building, call 219-462-5821. That's 219-462-5821. We thank you for your generous support. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager and engineer of the show, though Esther's behind the console today learning how to engineer the show. By the way, if you are a listener, and we have done our community campaign, but we're still looking for your support. So while the campaign is going on past, we will always take it. It's a tax-deductible contribution. Esther and I would especially invite you to become underwriters of our program, Art on the Air. And so you can be a basic underwriter support. You go to WVLP.org/support. We have underwriter levels for different levels of businesses. You get mentioned on the air. You can go to the website. It'll talk you through it. And so we want to encourage you not just to be a listener, but become a supporter of what we're doing here with Art on the Air and the entire station operation. And I always like to say this, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. So anyway, our show is broadcast on Mondays at 5 p.m. And if you miss this show, we rebroadcast it at 5 p.m. on Mondays. So you can take a listen to this show again. And next week, we're taking just a little end-of-the-year break, and we're going to do kind of a best-of show. So on the December 28th show with the rebroadcast, we'll be doing kind of a best-of encore segment and everything. We'll be back on January 4th with the folks from Art Z Gallery. It's a brand-new gallery in Chesterton. That's Bridget Zdalski and Kathy DeLeo, and they'll be here there. So anyway, we want to wish you a happy holiday season as we get into our arts calendar. And first, we're going to Porter County and Brower Museum. They are coming in January. They're doing Icons on Ammo Box, and it's art by Sofia Altadova and Alskander Klemenko. So that's coming in January. You can go to their website to see kind of a preview of it. The Strimbu Gallery continues with the photography of Asher Yates on the second floor, and that's going to continue probably through the end of this I think it's a veterans exhibit, so it's on the campus there. And good luck with The Sun and Other Works, Krista Steinke's and their other gallery. The Ellen Firm Gallery on US 12 in Beverly Shores. And now this December through the end of January, we'll have Holly Jackson's art, and it's a selection of her newest paintings from 2018. So you can see Holly's work there. She's based in Chesterton on 2nd Street there. The Village Gallery at Pines has December 9th through January 17th. Oil artist Lori Shimmer Carpenter, and she'll be there. You can see that. Chesterton Art Center continues through the 24th. So that's you've just got a few days left on that Duneland Plein Air member exhibit at the Chesterton Art Center. Uptown Cafe continues with Liz Werfel's exhibit. It's been there for some time now, but you can still catch that. And Memorial Opera House, a Christmas cabaret on Wednesday, December 19th. Oh, there's a past one, so I missed that one. I just forgot to take that one out. So that one's already gone. So there. We're now going to go to Esther, who is the maven of LaPorte County.
Aloha. Lubeznik Center for the Arts has Waiting for a Sign. It continues the exploration of the use of signage, text, and iconographic visual images and symbols in the work of 8 contemporary artists. And it's showing in the Hyman, Brinkett Cross, and Susan Block Galleries through January 12th. So it's coming to a close, so please go see that. Southern Shore Art Association December holiday exhibit is The Gift of Art, and that continues through the end of the month, and they have expanded offerings in their gift shop, and they are located at 724 Franklin Street in Michigan City. For more information, visit their website at southernshoreartassociation.com or visit their Southern Shore Art Association Facebook page. SFC Gallery has the Dig the Dunes 2019 calendar, and they're exhibiting the winning photographer's work through the end of December. Larry Breckner, my co-host, he has an image on the July page, Washington Park Dune Dusk. So I heard there's only a couple of those calendars left.
I think they're sold out.
I talked to Eve yesterday, and she had 2, I think, left.
I went and bought one for a friend of mine who wanted one, Mary Levan, who's, you know, all over the dunes, and I gave it to her for a Christmas present. But yeah, she was like down to like, I think you're right. I think she's gone. They're gone. Right,
they're sold out then. All right. Well, so, but you can see the images at the FFC SFC Gallery, excuse me, through the end of the month. The Thaddeus C. Gallery in downtown La Porte is hosting Blue Christmas. It's their 14th annual holiday exhibition with a wide variety of work from Indiana-based artists, as well as artists from Chicago, Milwaukee, New York, New Jersey, Vermont, and England. The exhibition runs through January 5th, so that's closing really soon. Their hours are Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, and Saturdays from 10 until 3. Their phone number is 219-326-8626. Blink Contemporary Art in Michigan City at 1709 Franklin Street is exhibiting the new work of Rick Lang and Suzanne Cohen Lang. It will feature their paintings, drawings, and sculptures. Rising Phoenix Gallery at 2803 South Franklin Street. Their December exhibition is Joy to the World, and it's a mixed media exhibit. The Nest, located at 803 Franklin Street, has the exhibit. They're exhibiting David and Margie Kreiner's work. David's exhibiting his abstract paintings and Margie her geometric paintings. Toastmasters every first and third Monday of the month at 6:15. Well, I think most of the places in Michigan City will be open through the weekend. Will be open through December 24th from about 2 until 7 p.m. for the rest of the week. Today, not until 3. So visit us at The Nest Michigan City on Facebook. And that is it for La Porte County.
Yeah, and probably things are going to get quiet. I know a lot of galleries, at the very end of the year and into it, kind of take a hiatus there. So
not really. We still do First Fridays all through the year. Wow. We don't take a hiatus on that.
I don't know if we Southern Shore. I know. I don't think we have an exhibit scheduled then. But maybe okay. So that's good to know. There, all the galleries are happening. We were just taking the break there. Well, moving on to Lake County now. The South Shore Arts registration is still open for the winter class sessions. They begin on January 7th. So contact them at their Facebook page or website, South Shore Arts. Indie Windy Love Story still running through January 29th. It will feature artists from Indiana and Chicago, and these are large works throughout the thing on aging urban areas, curated by Ish Muhammad. The Atrium Gallery, well, actually the Symphony Society, the Women's Society from the Symphony, has Festival of Trees, and that'll be through the end of the month, so if you still want to see all the beautiful trees decorated. But then, coming in January, I think on January 11th, James Jakowiak, he'll be there. He's a Chicago-born artist. He'll have his current paintings, focuses on the role of color and form, and how it interacts with the environment. That'll be in the Atrium Gallery at the center. South Shore Arts Crown Point branch continues with Mike Barakalowski's Wildscapes, and that's going to continue through January 5th. Cafe Fresco, Laura Izzard, Cats and Space Aliens will be on exhibit through January 27th, and that's on 1 North Court Street in Crown Point. Toll Theater has oil artist, once again, Lori Shimmer Carpenter, and she'll be feature her in January. 119th Street Artists, they'll be wrapping up their children's exhibit through the end of December, and so you can see details at the that's Oliver Brown exhibit. The Oliver Brown exhibit is still going through until January 16th, the Cornerstone Gallery, that's in the back of the Centier Bank. Studio 659 has their children's exhibit, which wraps up at the end of this month. And Miller Beach and Arts Creative District, Kevin Firm, will have an exhibit through January 6th at the Marshall J. Gardner Arts Center. He has 38 drawings, 28 sculptures on display. You can contact millerbeacharts.org or Miller Beach Arts. And that's all of our things that are happening in the area. Remember, if you'd like to get an arts-related event on the air, or you'd like to appear with us, you can't really appear on radio, but I guess in a sense you can, go to our email at artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. That's artontheairwvlp@gmail.com, and you can then become part of our Art on the Air program.
Yeah, we want to promote you, so please, please, artontheairwvlp.com. Gmail.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, please. So utilize that.
Well, we're excited to have our guest today, who's escaped corporate America, taught college management for 8 years before returning to his family farm in Northwest Indiana. He's a great storyteller, reading, writing books. He has published 3 works of nonfiction, a photo book of old car crash scenes. And now, when he's not farming, he obsesses over old photo negatives and imbibing on local beer. I guess that's a very very artistic thing. Plotting His Next Adventure. Please welcome to Art on the Air, Matt Warner. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Hey. Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to be here. Well, tell us a little bit about your background, starting with the farm, and just a little bit about Matt so our listeners can...
Yeah, what was it like growing up?
Oh, growing up on a farm, what was it like? Well, that's a lot of work, that's for sure. A lot of dirty work. Mm-hmm. I remember once, and a lot of farm people out there can really recognize this. I remember once when I was at Bowling Green State University, I got my master's in business there, and I was working on a program in entrepreneurship. Had to interview some successful entrepreneurs, and one of them was the Andersons. They own a large grain buying and selling business. I mean, we're talking enormous, enormous. And he was in his 80s at the time, and he and I were sitting and talking, and we're in his office, and it's pretty fancy and pretty nice, and started talking about farming, and I said, you know, I go, it's really hard to think, I just can't think of work as being hard work unless I get dirty. And he loved that because he said, oh, I know exactly what that means. And he and I had a long talk because he grew up on a farm also. And then they started this very successful business. So, you know, when you're a farmer and you're a farm kid, you get drafted into doing whatever work is necessary. And most of that work requires sweat, sometimes cold or crappy weather, requires a lot of dirt and, you know, a lot of physical exertion on your muscles and your joints. It's tough. It's very tough. But it's also a lot of fun because literally you are in this incredibly enormous playground that most people don't have an opportunity. You know, it's not just outside, but, you know, for fun, I'd go outside and you'd climb a grain bin and sit on top of the grain bin and just stare out at the fields and the trees and the neighbor's house a mile away.
You might
away.
Say that's a free way of getting high, right?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, you can say that. Yeah, my dad and I were talking about that play on words the other day, and I said, I remember a t-shirt when I was a kid that said, get high on milk or cows eat grass.
There you go.
I always wanted one when I was a kid, and I never got one, but anyways, yeah, it was a playground. I mean, you'd climb a grain bin and sit up there, and you know, you're riding a three-wheeler when you're 10 years old, and you know, even though you're told to go slow as soon as you're out of sight.
Of course.
You know, you gave it hell, so, you know, full throttle.
So what type of farming do you do?
Corn and soybeans.
Okay.
Yeah, you're typical grains in Indiana.
Okay, so what kind of corn? Is that like sweet corn or?
No, field corn, field industrial corn. So most of it goes into animal feed or industrial purposes, okay. Such as ethanol. Some of it's used to make plastics, things of that nature. So there's all kinds of different things they actually use corn for beyond just feed.
Right. Biodegradable now.
Oh, yeah.
Takeout containers.
Yep.
That'd be great to be going to that instead of plastic bags at the grocery store, mm-hmm. which I feel guilty about sometimes, and I want to get them instead of paper, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. So, you know, corn and soybeans, which is the Indiana staples, really.
Well, now, just this is not art related, but now with what's happening with the trade thing, how's that affecting you?
Oh, soybean prices are rotten.
Okay.
It's awful. So, you know, it is what it is. You know, you take your crop in and it's worth, you know, 20, 25, 30% less than what it was a year ago.
Wow.
And it's a commodity. So there's not so much, you know, there's nothing I can really do to say, hey, look at, buy my soybeans and give me an extra dollar. It's like,
right.
It's a soybean. It's the same as the other guy's selling. So, but yeah, so far it's been pretty bad. Lots of people are storing as much as possible.
How long can you store that? I know this is getting off the art subject, but I'm actually fascinated with this.
You've got... It depends, and without getting too in-depth, you've got less than a year.
Okay.
Safely. Because it depends on the moisture content of the grain that you're storing, and then it depends on the ambient temperature outside. So, you know, if it's really dry and you've got good air inside your bin, which, you know, bins are not exactly well-known for lots of air, but if you've got decent air inside the bin and it's good moisture, a low moisture content, you can store it. You know, for a good year, possibly longer, but you don't want to. I mean,
no.
you want to get rid of it before, you know, the 4th of July or so. If you don't have the proper temperature if you don't have the proper moisture and then it gets hot, it starts to rot inside the grain bin. And then, you know, corn smells kind of bad when it gets rotten. Beans are absolutely putrid when they get, you know, you don't want to be anywhere near that when they get rotten. So... But, yeah, you know, roughly 9 months.
Okay. That's fascinating. Like that. I mean, my mother grew up on a truck farm in Highland, but I was just little. So by the time I came along, I didn't know it. It was like right on Ridge Road there. And My grandfather, I remember she told stories about them taking the produce into Gary to sell. So, and that was during the Depression, though. So, now, how large is your farm?
We're pretty small, by modern standards. You know, today a farmer can easily farm like 1,000 acres by himself pretty handily, and we're smaller than that.
Okay.
So, relatively modest by modern standards. I mean, there's people who, there's people who can farm 1,500, 2,000 acres by themselves, with the equipment that's available today. There's lots of farmers, if they've got two people or three people, they're farming 4, 5, 6,000 acres.
Wow.
So, but I can't remember what the average is around here. The national average of farm size, I think, is 650 or 700 acres or something like that. But you have to realize for every farmer who has 2,000 acres, there's 20 or 30 hobby farmers who have 20 or 40.
Right.
So it skews a lot lower than reality in terms of full-time what you've got. But, yeah, the days of it being laborious are long gone. I mean, it was, everybody thinks, oh, you're a farmer, so you have to get up at the crack of dawn, and you sweat all day. You're like, not so much anymore. The job is really more about operating equipment than anything else. Heavy equipment, of course, you got to maintain it and work on it, but, it's more of a, operating heavy equipment these days.
Now, do you co-op equipment with other farmers? I mean, so you don't all have to buy everything?
We own everything.
You own everything you have.
Yeah. I mean, the windows in terms of like a planting season are pretty small.
Okay.
So there actually are, you could say, well, sure, you can plant any time between, say, the 20th or 25th of April if conditions are right at the earliest. And sure, you can plant corn in June, but you don't want to because you're losing yield. So in terms of your optimal window, it's really, really small, especially around here with weather conditions. You've got optimal conditions less than 30 days. You probably, if it was perfect and say I could pick my days, you're really down to more like 10
or
15 days that are perfect for, I want to plant these days.
Right.
If it's possible. So, that's why everybody has their own thing and everybody runs out because, if it's the 2nd of May and all of a sudden the sun breaks out and it's 70 degrees and the ground temperature is where it needs to be, you're out there going hard because it's perfect conditions to get it in the ground.
Wow.
And you say, oh, well, I'll just wait a week or so. There's no hurry. Well, yeah, there is, because you're going to, you're going to cost yourself 10, 15, 20 bushels to the acre. So there is, there are
pressure.
Yeah. I mean, there are cost considerations. There are revenue considerations. It's like telling a business, hey, you could sell 100 items today, or you could wait and sell 80 next week. You're like, hell no, I'm going to sell.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah, you're listening to Farming on the Air. No kidding.
Yeah.
It's Art on the Air on WVLP, and we're talking to Matt Werner here, and we're just getting the background on the farming, but we're actually going to move on to something. Well, tell us about a little bit of your college background, too.
Mm-hmm. I've got an undergraduate degree from Purdue University. Used to teach middle school and high school for a short period of time.
God bless you.
Yeah, middle school wasn't bad. High school, I liked that better than the high school.
Really?
Yeah, I taught 7th grade, and 7th grade was still goofy enough that they wanted to be your friend.
Right, yeah.
16-year-olds didn't want to be your friend at all.
Well, I was a theater director at Munster, so all my kids were that, but I always say that to middle school. I said, I always think they should abolish middle school and send them to slave labor camps. Send them to the farm, work on the farm. harness that whole mental energy, and everything. So when they get to high school, there's something to do. So anyone that teaches middle school, well, my wife actually directed middle school theater.
K-1 is my favorite, so I kind
of. Oh, there you go. That's when you just kind of gather.
Second and third grade, too.
Just gather your little chicks onto you. That's a thing. But okay, Purdue. And
Purdue University, worked construction for a little bit, and then I went back, got a master's degree in business administration from Bowling Green State in Ohio, and then went to Chicago and worked in corporate America for a bank, and then I worked for a sales consulting firm and another healthcare consulting firm for a short period of time. Then I wound up teaching college in Wisconsin and then in Ohio.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So that's and then what drove you to back to the farm?
Just things change, opportunity, give it a shot, come back. My father was getting older and thinking about quitting and that sort of thing. So, yeah. So it just seemed like the right time to do so.
Okay.
What year was that?
Oh, 3 years ago, I think.
Three?
Yeah. Yeah. Have to break the calendar out and look more critically. But, yeah. Now, teaching college, that was the easiest by far because it doesn't matter what's happening at home. It's like,
right.
There's a lot less drama. It's like, well, show up and do the work or don't.
Right. Yeah. I know I occasionally adjunct professor for Purdue and everything. In fact, they contact me about teaching an acting class, which I don't know if it's going to go yet. But yeah, you're right. It's they're either there or you're not. But you still care about them. I had this one girl who was commuting from Illinois, and she could have taken the same class at the Hammond campus. She was coming out to Westville. And I said, they didn't tell me. I said, well, we could fix this anyway. She was not showing up enough to be in class. So yeah. Trying to encourage them.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's still that, you're still a teacher. There's still a relationship and mentoring and, you know, doing the best for them and doing the absolute best you can to help them learn. But there's definitely a lot less drama at the college level.
That's true. Yeah. Well, I always told my theater kids, keep the drama on the stage, not off stage. So
there you go.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck with that. You should work in Hollywood.
So I know. Well, that's true. But when you get that level, it's a whole different thing. So, well, the reason we have Matt here is more about the farming's been very interesting. Actually, I could almost do a show on that. We'll call it Farming on the Air.
But I know. My kids, I'm always pointing out, I have a thing, I love silos. I just think they're fabulous, and so I'm always pointing out the signs.
They're great photographic subjects. Some of
them aren't many left. They keep tearing them down.
I know.
They don't have much purpose left anymore. So they just.
Except I've seen some being rehabbed into like interesting homes or offices or
There's a website that it's old silos and grain bins that have been converted to houses. Oh. It's like holy smokes, that's bizarre, especially a grain bin. I
mean,
it's just a tin can. Like okay, but people have done it, and they look kind of cool, but. I don't know if I'd go that far.
They photograph really cool.
Yeah, there you go. Why'd you build this very expensive house in a tin can? Because it photographed well.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, Matt is also a storyteller and author, and that's kind of what we're talking about. He's got three works of nonfiction and a bunch of other articles. So you want to tell us a little bit, first of all, how you got into doing that? And
The first book was called Season of Upsets, and that was a project that I'd thought about that I wanted to write for like 18 years, and I just never got around to it. And then I'm trying to think what year that would have been when I finally got serious. 2011? And something happened, and sort of the stars aligned, I guess, to make a long story really, really short. The stars aligned, and some information and some stuff kind of popped up, like, wow, this happened. So I decided initially, I'm like, okay, well, I'll just interview. And it was about the 1950 basketball season in LaPorte County, which was the quintessential Hoosier basketball story. And it was such a long time ago that nobody really remembers it. And, you know, and everybody was in their 80s who was there. And so most people hadn't heard about it. I was aware of it, but I didn't even know all the facts. So I said, well, okay, I'll just sit down and I'll interview the surviving members of the team that won. And when I sat down and talked to them, just things kept popping up. And I'm like, wait, what happened? Yeah, this. I'm like, you kidding? No, look it up. I said, all right, fine. And after that happened about four or five times, and then I talked to three of the guys that were still alive from that team, and I looked some of this up, and then I started realizing it wasn't just one team that had the surprise upset. It was just one incredibly bizarre circumstance, wild thing happening after another. Mm-hmm. And that's when I said, okay, we need to do a deep dive and write this book. And again, I always wanted to write a book, and I sat on it for 18, 19 years.
So in high school, did you show a talent for writing? Because you really are a gifted writer.
I guess so. I mean, you know, my English teacher would say so. Or at least one English teacher would say so.
School paper or anything like that? Or
yeah, I had one English teacher who really liked what I had written, was encouraging. But then again, how many high school kids can say that? You know, it was probably a long list. But I don't think, you know, my writing really didn't mature until I decided I'm going to write this book, and I started working on it, and I quickly realized, okay, you may have been pretty good in the past, good enough for a teenager or whatever, but, you know, you got to do some more. And that's when I was working at Miami of Ohio, and you could take classes for free, so I signed up for a creative nonfiction class, and her name was Gina Patterson, and she was fantastic. And, I mean, talk about learning quickly, and it was fun because there was another non-traditional student who was the same age as me who was working on his undergraduate degree. So, you know, I was working at the university and taking a class, and he was working his undergrad. We're the same age. And so he was a really good writer. He still is. So we got to share a lot of stuff. And that's really when, in terms of my skills and just kind of getting it honed, really took off. So it's like, okay, I can tell a story, but now there's certain practices, certain skills, certain things,
rules,
technical details that can make you better. And learning those, and they weren't even that sophisticated, but then all of a sudden it really took off. And I think my writing got way, way better as a result of that class.
Now, did you have an editor work on your book, or did you self-edit?
The first one, yes. It took me, over 2 years to research because I interviewed over 70 people. I had hundreds of pages of microfilm from newspapers to try and get the full facts, lots of other material, first-hand sources, things of that nature. So I'm trying to tell this incredibly huge story and all the weird things that are happening and try and describe the life and the times. And I couldn't see the forest through the trees anymore.
Right.
And I read it and read it again and made some changes. And I'm like, I know it needs something, but I don't know what it is. So I hired an editor who did developmental edits. And then I hired again to do my final proofread. Because, again, I was at that point, I was getting tired. And I'm like, okay, I've done pretty good. But, you know, I need somebody who's really good with Chicago Manual to really fine-tune this and hit it hard. And she was great. So
this for Season of Upsets?
Season of Upsets. Yeah. And I've told lots of people who want to write a book, and, you know, if it's a big book and they're putting a lot of work into it and it's just their passion project takes a lot of time, I'm like, go hire an editor. It's going to be the best $1,000 you're going to spend. And it was, because my editor pointed out all kinds of things that I, you know, needed to look at, and I looked at it again. And that's the hard part when an editor looks at something you've spent this insane amount of time on. You put 1,000 hours into this thing, and then they go, yeah, you know, these three chapters need to go. You're like, oh, screw you. You don't know anything. So you gotta be smart, and you gotta take a step back, and you gotta say, okay, she's trying to help you. She's saying this for a reason. And just because they provide advice doesn't mean you have to take it. So when you look at it from that way, it was extremely valuable, because there were a couple chapters where she said, you know, this is the arc of your story. What is school buses? You had an entire chapter about school buses. What's the deal? And then there were two more chapters that were like that, and she says, what's the deal? And, you know, at first you take a step back, and you're like, okay, I see what she's saying. This is way too far into the weeds here. But there was some important content trying to get people to understand what life was like at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, school buses were total junk in 1950. I mean, they were a tin can on wheels, literally. As a matter of fact, the small township-run schools, the person who was contracted to drive a bus, they owned the chassis with the motor and a steering wheel, and then the school owned the box.
Wow.
Yeah, so the passenger part where all the kids sat were the seats. So the school would literally just, you know, they'd plop it onto the frame, put a couple of welds on, and off you'd go. When you didn't want to drive bus anymore, you had a disagreement, or you lost the contract, they took the box and put it on another chassis.
I didn't know that.
So, you know, there were things that I wanted to put in terms of, you know, and they were really, really bad condition. They weren't good. So anyways, but yeah, do we need a whole chapter on that? No, we did not. Was it important to try and discuss the life and times? Yeah. So I was able to take, you know, her suggestion of, you know, you're in the weeds here. And I took three chapters and I combined them into one. And then when she looked at it again later, she said, wow, this, you know, she was really, she liked the way it got put together. And she said, okay, well, now it makes sense, because it's a life and times explaining their experience thing rather than a whole chapter on buses. And it's like, yeah, it was only a couple pages now, and it just kind of
flowed
with a couple other things to say, well, this is what their lives were like when they grew up in the 40s and 50s.
Wow.
So
you're listening to WVLP Art on the Air, and our guest is Matt Warner talking about, his first book writing and everything. And again, this will be rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m. So Matt, tell us a little, maybe an excerpt from that first book, something. I mean, you told us a little about the bus, which I was fascinated, but maybe one little.
Other tidbits. One of the things that I found, and I have a tendency to find a piece of information and then wonder about it and then get carried away to this insane degree that probably most artists do, when they'll spend forever like looking about, should I add this extra brush stroke or not? Mm-hmm. And they just drive themselves mad. And I do that. Most of all my stuff's nonfiction so far. And there was one component. There were 15 high schools in LaPorte County, so 15 head coaches. And I started looking, and I found, I think about half of them, I was able to find out five of six or six of seven were World War II veterans.
Okay.
I'm like, well, I wonder how many were and what did they do? And, you know, everybody thinks that you can find everything on the internet, and that's so nonsensical. You try and look up 15 people, most of who are now gone, and find out whether they were actually a World War II veteran or not. Yeah. It took an insane number of hours for me to actually just put one sentence and then a graph in the book showing who they were and whether they were a World War II vet or not and what service that they were in. It turned out 13 of the 15 were World War II veterans that were coaches that year, which, again, you look at that, and that's kind of important in terms of life, times, picture, image. Sure. You know, 13 of the head coaches were serving in a war just 5 years, 6 years earlier.
I know.
So, you know, it's a different thing. All these kids who played on these teams would have experienced that. They all, or most of them, had a coach who was in World War II. Most of the people I talked to, and I talked to fans, not just players, they talked about their teachers. Lots of teachers, especially male teachers, were World War II veterans. And you bet every one of those guys would talk about that in their classes, in their practices. You know, they would sort of explain what some of their experiences were like. Some of them more graphically and weirdly than others. Because some of the players were like, geez, you know, you didn't need to tell us those graphic details. You know, and other coaches were a little more like, it was serious. And you got to realize there's some bad things in this world. But anyways, it took, you know, an incredible amount of hours to track down every single one of these coaches to find out, did they serve in World War II or not? And if not, what were they doing then?
Where do you get that research from? I mean, you know, since it's not... You know, I know so much work is done on the internet with mm-hmm. modern stuff, but things like that, you really have to go old school. Old Google, where you pull the cards out of the library.
Yeah, literally. So for some of these people, you had to try and find out, okay, is there a, you know, you'd start with a player. What was his name? Do you know anybody who kept, you know, what happened to him? Well, he moved away to a different school a couple of years later. Okay. Anybody know who his kids are? Anybody know where he went? Well, I think he went to such and such. Okay. So then you go to that community and try and look up some information or call the library and see if they find anything and try to track down where did the person retire, possibly. Because one of them, gosh, I mean, he moved a lot and I had to basically track him all the way down to Florida at about six stops. And a lot of it was just trying to call people and then look and some internet search, but you know, if you got a common name like a Paul Smith.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Paul Smith, was he a World War II veteran? Good luck with that. You know, so.
So from start to finish, how long did it take, do you think, from the concept to the completion?
The whole book or just that part?
No, the whole book.
The whole book, I'm trying to remember, I've got it written down somewhere. It was over 1,600 hours total. Including research, and then I did all of the design and layout myself for the inside because I knew what I wanted to look like, and I was kind of picky. Every time I talked to somebody about doing layout, they pretty much had their way, and I want it my way. So, yeah, it was over 1,600 hours total. So,
wow, that's a lot of work putting a book together. Of course,
a lot of detective work.
Yeah. So another topic you've done is the book is the White Sox Life from Hoosier Farm to 42 Years in Major League Baseball.
Glenn Rosenbaum. Guy lives in Union Mills, Indiana, and he was just a poor farm kid. And he grew up on the farm that neighbored my dad's. Glenn's older brother and my dad's older brother were best friends. And Glenn grew up on a farm, and it was a pretty small, modest farm. And he graduated high school, and he was a pretty good baseball player for this small county school. And working with his dad on the farm, didn't know what he was going to do. And he was playing what he called beer league, Sunday league baseball. And they played at Elkhart, South Bend, I think Niles, Michigan City. And, you know, all of a sudden one guy says, hey, you know, Jim Peterson playing baseball professionally? He's like, yeah, right. And I said, I'll have a scout look at you. Okay. Next Sunday, he pitches a game, and Scott walks over to him after the third inning and hands him a business card and says, be at Comiskey Park at 7 o'clock Tuesday.
Wow.
Bingo.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of an amazing story because he went to Comiskey. He didn't even know how to get to Comiskey Park. Nobody in his family knew how. So I started calling friends, and he had a cousin who had been there. He goes, yeah, I've gone to a game there before, and, you know, I've been with Wally. He goes, we'll take you. Because, you know, I mean, the family had to sit down and try to call people, like, how are we going to get to Comiskey Park? None of us have ever been there. So, you know, they had to work that out. And, yeah, they ended up offering him a minor league contract. And next thing you know, he he didn't get a call up to the majors because it's a long story. Well, it's in there, but he kind of got screwed over. There were some politics involved that had nothing to do with him, but he got caught up in it. But he ended up spending 42 years in the organization in one capacity or another.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of amazing because he'll even say, he goes, you know, playing, you know, that day before he met the scout, even when he met the scout, like, did he have any ambition, thoughts, whatever, that he would work for a Major League Baseball team for 42 years? No. No. And he met some pretty amazing people. I mean, you know, he can just go through the list of all these people that he's met and worked with and enjoyed and appreciated. And, you know, some of his favorite people to talk to, like Bob Feller. He became good friends with Bob Feller, who's a Hall of Fame pitcher who pitched for the Cleveland Indians. You know, he's one of the people Glenn really liked. So, yeah, that was an interesting one because that was literally just sitting down with Glenn. And I did a little bit of research, but the vast majority of it was sat down and started a recorder. And we did four sessions of about an hour and a half each time, and then transcribed all of that, and then pulled the transcription to try and weave the story together.
Well, that would be that from your previous book. That was probably a little less research intensive then.
Yeah, yeah. At least in terms of like having to hunt down information. So there was a little bit, but not so much.
Did you go to the park? And were they free with their information?
I didn't really do that because I was literally focused just on Glenn and his story. I could have, because it was funny because right before I finished the story, and at first Glenn really hated the idea. He's like, whatever. He was really kind of squirming in the chair while I'm interviewing him. And I've known Glenn forever. We're good friends. I mean, our families go back a long time. Anyways, he was kind of uncomfortable and kind of squirming, but then after kind of warmed up and then he saw I gave him like what I was working on. He liked it, and so we were going, and he was happy with it. But you know, the White Sox organization, had I needed to, they would have been fine. That's just not the story. Just never went there. Before I finished it, and that ended up being the finale, he and I went to a game. I go, hey, let's go to a game. He goes, okay. And Glenn's thing is always, and it's today, same thing. If I call him, like, you want to go to a game? He's like, okay, you drive. I'll get the tickets. And he just calls. Because he still knows everybody who works there. So, you know, he calls and we drive up there and, you know, we get special parking because he just pulls in the parking lot and they holler at us, what are you doing here? And he rolls the window down and he goes, how's it going, fellas? And, hey, Rosie, how's it going? You know, he's been retired for 20 years and parking lot guys love him. But, you know, it was kind of funny because we're walking down the hallway and he's like a hero in that building. He hasn't worked there for 20 years. And you walk down the hallway and, you know, everywhere he ducks around the corner and doesn't even say anything. He ducks around the corner to see if they're busy or not because he never wants to interrupt anybody. And they just spot him and they just scream like, Rosie! They're like, I'll call you back. And they slam the phone down. They run out into the hallway. I mean, you know, like the president of the organization and the general manager, all these guys do this.
Yeah, he's that Indiana charm.
Yeah. I mean, he's a big deal. So, yeah, we went to a game and that was kind of fun because everybody was like, you know, hey, what are you doing here? He's like, yeah, just came to watch a game.
Now, did you see the game at the new park or the old Comiskey?
That one was at the new park.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you feel about the new park versus the old park?
They're totally different.
Yeah, what did he feel about it?
Like, oh, him? He loved the new park.
Okay.
Simply because he worked in it.
Okay.
So, you know, fans always have these emotional attachments to it, and they want the... they want the pillars and they want the old brick and they want the insides falling apart. But from his perspective, trying to work there and try to get between the front office and the clubhouse and back and forth and between the bullpen and everything, it was a nightmare because he had to like put jams and doors to squeeze in and out of places. And, you know, the offices were really lousy. I mean, the building was, and he said this, and I love the old Comiskey. And I said, boy, I wish they would have just rebuilt that. And he said, Matt, you have no idea how bad it was. It would have cost twice as much to renovate that place. Mm. And it still wouldn't have been adequate because, you know, it's just the office space and everything, it just wasn't there.
Yeah.
So he goes, it would have been a fortune and it wouldn't have been as good as what they have now. So from the working perspective, so much better because the offices were better, getting around was better, everything was cleaner, everything was nicer, everything was more professional. So, yeah, he thinks it's great. He understands that whole emotional Like, well, yeah, of course everybody likes that, but you know, you got to realize this is also a place of work. I get it's a place of entertainment, but it's also a place of work.
Well, the Northsiders probably would never do that with Wrigley, though. That's almost like an icon in baseball. So
yeah, exactly.
Of course, the family's put a lot of money into that renovating. We're talking to Matt Warner here on Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, talking about his authorship and everything, and also talked a little bit about farming. So it was almost like farming on the air. So your third book. Tell us a little bit about that. How sweet it is.
How sweet it is. It's a story about the 1966 Elston Red Devils. Of course, they won the state championship that year. So, and that one was pretty, it's pretty straightforward. That was a very fairly easy one to write. Took 2 months, about full time. So it was just a big single push to get all the information. Had some really good sources because I think all of the players but one are still alive, and I was able to interview four of them at one time, four of the five starters. Sat down with them all at the same time. The assistant coach was still alive at the time. He passed away a little over a year ago. The high school principal was alive. He just passed away a few weeks ago. He was 97 when he passed away. But anyways, so yeah, it was easy to get those, find those guys, get the inside information. And, you know, when I met people and they're like, well, I don't need to read about it. I lived it. I was there. I'm like, you think you were.
You're right. Because you have everybody's perspective, the students, the cheerleaders, the whole organization. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's what lots of people, I had, you know, and there's some people who think they, you know, we all come across as everybody thinks they know everything, it seems like, especially if they witnessed it. It's like, yes. I know everything. Okay.
From your perspective.
Right, exactly. But then I had some other people who, they really enjoyed it because they said, I had no idea that basketball players practiced that much. Like, I just thought they showed up for a game. Like, no, there's a tremendous amount of work behind the scenes that goes into it. And there were some behind the scenes stories that these guys told me that had never been written, ever. Nobody talked about it. Some things that happened in the locker room, especially at the state championship, and everybody's like, whoa. I mean, you know, one of the players literally put
you'll have to get the book and read it to find out what he's talking about.
Put everybody into a dead silence right there in the locker room, and then, you know, his few words was the motivational punch that they needed. That they were good, they had a chance, but you know, after Fred LeBourne said that, they said, we knew we were going to win because, you know, we weren't going to let Fred down. So it's pretty cool, you know, and that's behind the scenes type stuff that you just can't get.
No.
Except you talk to the guys who are in the locker room, and you know, 50 years later, they still remember it like it just happened.
Where can people find your books?
Amazon.com.
Okay.
That's the easiest place.
And also, you do have a website, but it's not your name. So your Facebook page is facebook.com Season of Upsets. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and the website is just MatthewAWerner.com.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that one's easy.
And you're always welcome to have books in the shop, too.
There we go. At the Nest.
At the Nest, and maybe there's some other places that have gift shops around.
Yeah. So, yeah, try to keep things interesting. And, I mean, there's a lot of great stories around here. And just kind of, it's just, I wouldn't even say uncover them. It's just somebody has to tell them.
Right. So do you have a project you're thinking about, or?
There's always projects I'm thinking about, but which ones I'm going to pursue, because there's always the matter of, you know, how much time is it going to take? And then, of course, as all the artists out there in your community know, you put a lot of effort into something and you get zero return, and sometimes you don't want to pursue that
at
project.
At least initially. Sometimes it just takes time to mature. And
There's one project that I need to put the finishing touches on. I wrote a short story, biographical, about basketball, playing in the barn. And just sort of Indiana Hoosier basketball, and did an audio story. So recorded it. Patty Wisniewski helped me. She's one who did Shifting Sands and Everglades of the North. But need to put the finishing touches on that, and then try and find out how to circulate that. Sure. Hope to do that soon. I mean, it'd be nice January or February, you know, 1st of March at the absolute latest, get that finalized and put out to the world. So got that. I mean, there's always other stories that are constantly mulling around in my head. It's just...
Well, you write also for Dig the Dunes, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. I've written several stories for Dig the Dunes. Some of those are, you know, I've written about Jeff Manis, for example, quite possibly Northwest Indiana's most interesting interesting individual. And I laugh just because Jeff's a friend of mine, and I really enjoy talking to him. But he's an interesting character, a fun guy to be around. So I've written about him.
Lots of historical people, too.
Yep,
Harriet Colfax.
Yep, I've written about Harriet Colfax. I've written about the first terrorist flight attack where a plane actually crashed in Jackson Township in Porter County because a bomb went off on it. So I wrote about that. Trying to think what some of the other history. I wrote about the history of Miller one time for Dig the Dunes, things of that nature. So.
Also for the Beecher, I believe, in Michigan City.
Yeah, I used to write for them for a little bit. So
I was going down the list of all the places you've written and all the topics. It's like tremendous. I mean, I'm sure Eve at Dig the Dunes loves having you available.
Yeah, you did a great story on Bob Serco for us at the
Nest.
Yeah,
that was
a wonderful
Bob Serco
story.
That was a really cool story to write, and he's super cool, and his art's pretty amazing. I could just sit there and stare for hours at that. Like, oh, goodness.
Years and always see something different in his work.
I know, yeah.
So how do you balance your farming, like, time versus your writing time? I mean, farming, you probably go into a kind of a lull period. You have animals on your farm?
Nope, no
okay.
animals.
So that's a little less work.
So you've always got time down. Yeah. So, you know.
Do you have a special place you write, or?
In an office right now.
Okay.
Every single person has to kind of find their space. But literally for me, it's just, you know, be at a comfortable desk where somebody's not going to bother you and I'm okay.
Do you write on a computer or do you write a typewriter? Or
laptop.
Laptop?
Computer, because I actually use a keyboard instead of, you know, the laptop directly. But
right.
Yeah, I type. Typing is the best way for me. I've tried to, sometimes I'll do hand scribbles, but I can't write as fast as my brain goes. And with typing, it's a little bit, it's quicker, so it's a little bit easier. Teach their own. When it comes to writing, there's some people who like to dictate, some people who really do like to handwrite. People are really old school and they prefer to type with a typewriter. But yeah, for me, the keyboard is the best way to get it on the page.
Yeah. So. I know my process, and again, this is more different types of writing than what you do, is I tend to make my outline by just throwing one sentence on a page and then develop that into an outline. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to like, you know, they taught you in school, you have to make this formal outline. I would just throw different things on, and then you start kind of expanding on those. And then, of course, I love word processing where you can just move things around, you know, find that word. So
yeah, I found that. And sometimes you read, you know, writing magazines or writing blogs, and people argue about you need a outline, you don't need an outline, and that sort of stuff. And, you know, the fact of the matter is you just got to do what works for you. Outlines can be very valuable as long as you're willing to recognize you don't have to stick to it.
Right, you don't have to be rigid.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, okay, I've got this outline, and that's great, because basically an outline is nothing more than a bunch of ideas on a page.
Right.
Now, start writing, and if, you know, Roman numeral 4 comes before Roman numeral 2, who cares? Put it in there.
Exactly.
It's
just a guide.
Bingo.
That's what I used to do with a calendar for the school district I work for, and I finally told him, I says, you know, this calendar is a guide, not a god. You know, so like I said, the minute we publish this, it's already expired. And the same thing with something like an outline like that. So
yeah. I mean, if people really, you know, some people absolutely have to live by an outline. It's like, go right ahead. But, you know, be smart enough to recognize that it can change. And some people can't stand that rigidity and they struggle with that. And the same thing, you say, go ahead, just throw an outline. It can even be a crappy outline. You're just getting your ideas started. Right. You're basically creating a physical manifestation of your ideas. That's all you're really doing. And it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I wrote Season of Upsets, I had a 35-page outline?
Wow.
Because there were so many moving parts, I couldn't keep it all in my head. So I had to keep adding it to the outline. And then when I sat down and started typing, I would cross it out as I came to it and got it covered.
You know, you might get together with this person that has the Nest to Esther Gold, maybe do some book signings and readings.
Yeah, there we go.
We're talking about an exhibit. We've been talking about it for years, though.
The car crashes.
The car crashes. That's how we met.
Yeah. Yeah.
Car crash. Now tell us a little bit about that. That's historic photographs that you're putting.
Yeah, all photographs from the 1930s and 40s. They're 4x5 photo negatives, so they're large scale.
Right.
And the detail if the photo was taken in focus, the detail is it's insane.
Oh yeah.
I think you'd have to spend, and you'd probably know better than me, you'd have to spend a fortune on a DSLR that can capture the detail that these old 4x5 negatives can. So, here's this camera that's 80 years old and just simple lens and boom, and throw that down and then try and get a DSLR that's several thousand dollars. And
well, I have a 50 megapixel Canon DSLR that I do for landscape photography. And you're right. It's in the near $4,000 category.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I bought that, and just to get off subject for a sec,
sure,
is that when you're shooting, a lot of times you can either get the longer lens or everything, but I can still crop in and still have enough pixels to do a blow up of it. So, but you're right. The old large format 4x5, and of course the 8x10s, the landscape detail that like capture that is tremendous. So, what's in that? The car crash? What photos?
They're literally car crash scenes. And I originally started thinking, well, wouldn't it be neat to see these old cars? I mean, who wouldn't want to see a 34 Pontiac with a busted fender or something like that. The fact that they were busted is like, but how many people have this large volume of photographs of these old cars when they were actually on the streets, not, ones at a car show? And then when I started looking at these photos, I started realizing that, sure, the cars were cool, but it was all the stuff in the background that's just, oh my gosh. In the 30s and 40s, car crash scenes drew a crowd. Today we just keep the windows rolled up and the stereo turned up and the air conditioning blowing and, we slow down and rubberneck. As soon as we get past it, we hammer on the accelerator. In 1939, 1940, or even in the mid and late 40s, no, if there was a car crash, you pulled over to the side, got out of your car, and then got up close to see what happened.
Wow.
And then the photographer would show up on the scene to photograph it, either for insurance purposes, because they would sell them to insurance companies or the police department.
The newspaper.
Or for the newspaper. And all these people would still be there. They'd jump out and take a picture. And, cameras were still fairly, especially a big professional camera.
Yeah.
They were extremely rare in the 30s and 40s. So, this guy would show up in his car and come hammering up in his Oldsmobile and have his big camera. And he'd rush over to take photos. And people would literally, you could almost see they had to be shuffling. They would just shuffle into the background. They're all standing there smiling while he's photographing this car that's, it's the windshield's busted. And that somebody got hurt here.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they're quite, some of them are really kind of gruesome. But because of the way they're shot with all these smiling people in the background, it changes your view of it.
Yeah. And some of them resulted in serious accident or serious injury. Some of them, a surprising amount of them, people walked away when you actually go up and look up the details.
There's a few that are humorous.
Some of them are very funny. I mean, it was just a silly little mishap and everybody's laughing almost. But yeah, the ones in terms of really, really, gruesome, somebody getting thrown through a windshield, there's none of those. There's one or two that are, very sad, but under no circumstances would I say that they're gruesome.
Right. Not in the book. I'm not referring to the book.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Do those exist? Yes, but I didn't put them in the book. Right. Nothing macabre.
No.
But, just trying to capture piece of history, a bygone era. Some people have looked at the photos and been just blown away, but they're like, look at that. It's a power line. Today we don't even think about power lines anymore, because in 1940, power line would have, 80 or 100 wires on it. They're like, my God, look at that. Yeah.
Well, and the signage on the buildings. I mean, it's just really, quite a moment in history.
Oh, yeah.
Now that,
beyond the accident that's been captured.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, it's really less about the accident, although I hope people look to get an image of, these cars didn't have any safety features.
No.
But, I hope people notice that, look at the cars, but also see what's going on. I mean, the signage, the people, the clothing, the background, the houses, the streets, the street signs, all of these things are stuff that I hope people actually grab and take a look at and just get lost in the images. That's why I put it together, is so people could just stare at these and get lost in them forever, looking at all those fine details.
Time.
Yeah, cars back then were just like big metal boxes, too. I mean, heavy-duty boxes, so compared to today's automobiles.
Mm-hmm. So have you stayed in touch with any of the people that you've interviewed for your books, starting with the first one?
Yeah.
Are you still dialoguing?
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah, yeah. I don't talk to all of them all the time, but, you know, I hear from every once in a while and reach out with them every once in a while because it's a lot of people. Yeah, first book was 70 people, so, yeah. But, yeah, I'm in touch with all of them in one way, shape, form, or another. So, yeah.
Well, you're listening to Matt Warner here on Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and he's a escaped corporate America, become an author, and also farmer, and he's done that for some time.
Storyteller. I don't know if we have time to talk about Pecha Kucha, but
Maybe just for a couple minutes, and we can do that just as we wrap up here.
Yeah, Pecha Kucha. So I heard about that almost on a whim, and I thought, what an interesting way to tell a story. Pecha Kucha is a presentation where you have 20 slides. Each one is for 20 seconds. When your 400 seconds are over, the screen goes black and you need to be done telling your story. That's it. So I just thought it was a really cool and exciting way to tell a story. And so I told the story of why I created a book about car crash scenes at a Pecha Kucha presentation in St. Joe, Benton Harbor. And that's on their Pecha Kucha website. And you can also go to mine, MatthewAWerner.com, and scroll down and look for the Pecha Kucha presentation and click the link. 400 seconds, that's all it'll cost you in your time. And it was really, really fun and exciting way to tell a story.
Well, that sounds interesting. Yeah, kind of. You have to be. It's kind of like what they call the elevator speech when you're talking to someone. You think about, okay, what do you do? And then you got to think about, as long as an elevator ride is, to tell somebody something. So.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the whole idea, is you got 20 images or 20 slides and 20 seconds each time, and get it over with. It forces you to be disciplined. But it's fun. It's really cool. It's a great, unique, different way to tell a story.
Okay, so for curiosity for our farmers that might be listening out there, do you have green equipment or red equipment?
A little of both. Yeah, we don't care. Whatever works.
Whatever works.
Whatever works. Yep. Some people are diehard one color or the other. Not us. Yeah, planter and combine are green, or tractors are all red.
Okay.
Right now.
And silos.
One that's still standing. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Well, I think that we're about ready to wrap it up here. We appreciate you being here, Matt. It's a great interview.
Yeah, it was so much fun. Thank you so much.
And if you give us your website, your Facebook page, and if you want email, so they can contact you.
Yeah, the website is MatthewAWerner.com, and my last name is spelled WERNER. And it's Facebook.com/SeasonOfUpsets. And the email is mwerner97@gmail.com.
Well, thank you very much. You've been listening to Art on the Air. We'd like to thank Matt for being on the show today. Art on the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast at Monday at 5 p.m. Your hosts are Larry Breckner and Esther Golden. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP station manager and engineer. And again, if you're interested in being on the air with us, it's Art on the Air, WVLP@gmail.com. And remember, next week we're going to have a special encore presentation right here. And so you can hear some of our best interviews with Sherry Lemonnier, Marilee Jacoby Popovich, and from the Duneland Photography Club. So thank you so much, and see you next time.